From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now.
As I will continue to be on the side of the truth, on the side of the human rights, on the side of all those who know about what happened and stand firm with the Haitian people.
Today, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in his own words, in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, the most extensive interview the Haitian president has done since his ouster from Haiti. He talks about the Central African Republic after being kidnapped by U.S. forces, the U.S. occupation of his country, and the future of Haiti. And on this International Women's Day, we speak with Laura Flanders about her new book, Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, and longtime Native American leader, Winona LaDuke.
Greetings here on International Women's Day. I'm going to talk about Native women calling for peace against violence and alternatives to global climate change.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the U.S.-appointed Governing Council signed an interim constitution this morning in Baghdad. The signing was originally scheduled for last week, but was delayed twice after five Shia leaders walked out in protest. Council President Mohammed Bar al-Alum called the event a, quote, historic moment decisive in the history of our glorious Iraqi people. The Associated Press reported that just before the ceremony started, a large explosion was heard in Baghdad. No casualties were reported. On Sunday, at least seven rocket strikes hit the Al-Rashid Hotel and the Baghdad headquarters of the Coalition Provisional Authority. One U.S. contractor was wounded. Ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide met with reporters for the first time today and said he was kidnapped and forced from power by the United States. On Sunday, at least six people were killed, about 30 injured in Haiti when gunfire erupted in Port-au-Prince as thousands of marchers celebrated the overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We'll speak with President Aristide from the Central African Republic in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, Senator John Kerry has condemned President Bush's handling of the Haiti crisis, saying he would have sent in international troops to support the country's democratically elected leader. Kerry said Bush's response sent, quote, a terrible message to the region, democracies, and it's short-sighted, he said. Kerry also accused Bush of stonewalling separate investigations into the September 11th attacks and pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Israeli forces killed 14 Palestinians on Sunday, including three boys aged 8, 12, and 15. Almost 80 people were wounded, including 40 minors. Israel claimed the attack and Nusayrat refugee camps in Al-Burai as well targeted Palestinian militants. The BBC reported that most of the Palestinians killed were members of Hamas. There were no reports of Israeli casualties. The Associated Press reported it was the deadliest Israeli raid in Gaza in 17 months. On Saturday, six Palestinians died in a failed suicide bombing attack near a border crossing point between Gaza Strip and Israel. Meanwhile, Haaretz is reporting that Israel is now planning to delay its pullout from Gaza and removal of Jewish settlements there until after November at the urging of the White House. The paper reported the Bush administration is concerned the pullout could cause political problems in the United States before the elections. In economic news, new labor statistics show the U.S. economy added 100,000 fewer jobs than projected in February. According to the Labor Department, the entire gain of 21,000 new gains was the result of government hiring. There was no increase of jobs in the private sector. Senator Kerry responded to the news by saying, quote, "At this rate, the Bush administration won't create its first job for another 10 years. Since he took office, the U.S. economy has lost about 2.2 million jobs. Radio host Howard Stern is predicting his show may be pulled off the airwaves as early as this week because he's begun openly criticizing President Bush. Stern said last week, quote, "My days here are numbered because I dare to speak out against the Bush administration and say that the religious agenda of George W. Bush concerning stem cell research and gay marriage is wrong." And that is what he is doing with the FCC, is pushing this religious agenda, unquote. Radio giant Clear Channel recently pulled Stern off its stations, and now the Federal Communications Commission is threatening to levy a major indecency fine on the program. Stern said the criticism from Clear Channel and the FCC began when he started criticizing the Bush administration. Stern said, quote, "There's a religious agenda. They're winning. They control the media, Clear Channel, Fox, all of them, all part of the religious right. We've lost. We've lost our airwaves. We've lost our freedoms. We will be a religious state within 20 years, unquote. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee is warning 200 TV stations across the country to stop running ads from MoveOn.org criticizing President Bush. The RNC claims the ads violate federal election law. MoveOn defended the ads and said it's not surprising the Republican Party, quote, "continues to make false claims about the legality of our campaign in order to silence us." The former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Hans Blix, has told the Independent of London the war in Iraq had no legal, lawful justification and was illegal under international law. The Guardian of London's reporting the U.S. has begun hiring mercenaries from Chile to replace U.S. soldiers on security duty in Iraq. The private security company, Blackwater USA, last month now training 60 former Chilean commandos, including some who trained under Pinochet. The Independent of London is reporting that Britain's top scientific advisor, Ivan Rogers, has been muzzled by Tony Blair's government after he warned that global warming threatens and tortured detainees. The group reported civilians are being held in a legal black hole with no tribunals, no legal counsel, no family visits, and no basic legal protections. And in Seattle, the city's mayor has announced he will sign an executive order today requiring the city to recognize the marriages of gay city employees who get married elsewhere. Mayor Greg Nickels also said he'll ask the city council to pass an ordinance that would require contractors doing business with the city to recognize gay marriages among their own employees. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 6 people were killed and 30 injured in Haiti Sunday when gunfire erupted in Port-au-Prince. Among the dead was Spanish journalist Ricardo Ortega, who was shot in the chest while in the courtyard of a house where journalists had taken refuge from the shootings. Witnesses criticized U.S.-led troops for failing to prevent the violence. Reuters reports opposition leader Louis Jodel Chamblain signing autographs during the march. Chamblain was convicted in absentia of the killing of the former justice minister Guy Mallory during the coup of 1991 to 1994, among other crimes. Marchers also praised opposition leader Guy Philippe and hoisted him on their shoulders. Philippe said in a radio station in Haiti, he would not allow the security situation to further deteriorate. He and his top deputies would hold a meeting to reconsider their vow to lay down their arms. Philippe is a former Haitian police chief who was trained by U.S. Special Forces in Ecuador in the early 90s as was involved in an earlier coup in 2001. As the violence continues in Haiti, the status of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide remains an international controversy. Many nations have called for the United Nations to investigate his removal from power. Aristide remains in the Central African Republic and has had only limited contact with the outside world. He has accused the U.S. of kidnapping him, and his supporters say he has been held under lock and key like a prisoner. Well, a delegation of Americans arrived in Bangui in the Central African Republic to meet with Aristide. The delegation includes one of Aristide's lawyers, Brian Concannon, as well as representatives of former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. After being rebuked by the Central African government, they issued a statement accusing the government of holding Aristide like a captive. Today, though, The Central African Republic brought Aristide out to a news conference. Just before that news conference, the U.S. delegation was able to meet with him. And right after the news conference, President Aristide came to the phone in this exclusive interview on Democracy Now! To talk about his situation, the most extensive interview that he has conducted to date. This is what President Aristide had to say. I am Amy Goodman from the radio TV program Democracy Now! Around the United States. We would like to know why you left Haiti.
Thank you. First of all, I didn't leave Haiti because I wanted to leave Haiti. They forced me to leave Haiti. It was a kidnapping, which they call coup d'etat, or for some others, nothing else than something which is resignation. For me, it wasn't a resignation. It's a real kidnapping under the cover of coup d'etat.
It was a kidnapping under the cover of coup d'etat?
Yes.
Who forced you out of the country?
I saw U.S. officials through Ambassador Foley, Mr. Moreno, working for the U.S. Embassy in Haiti. I saw American soldiers. I saw foreigner soldiers linked to drug dealers like Guy Philippe, linked to killers already convicted as Chamblain. They all did their kidnapping using Haitian puppets like Guy Philippe, drug dealers, Chamblain, already convicted. And basically, this night, I didn't see Haitians. I saw Americans.
So you say that they kidnapped you from the country. Secretary of State Powell said that that is ridiculous. Donald Rumsfeld said that is nonsense. Your response?
Well, I understand they try to justify what they cannot justify, because when their ambassador, Ambassador Foley, told me that we were going to talk to the media, to the press, and I can talk to the Haitian people calling for peace like I did one night before. And unfortunately, once they put me in their car, for my resistance, a couple of minutes later, they put me in their plane, full with military, because they already had all the control of the Haitian airport in Port-au-Prince. As during the night, they surrounded my house and the National Palace, and we had some of them in the streets. I don't know how many are there. We are there. So it's clearly something they planned and they did. Now, if someone wants to justify what I think they cannot justify, that's their strategy. My goal is to tell the truth. This is what now I'm telling you the truth.
President Aristide, did you resign the presidency?
No, I didn't resign. We exchange words through conversations. We exchange notes. I gave a written note before I went to the press, as they told me. And instead of taking me where they were supposed to take me, front of the Haitian press, foreign press, to talk to the people, to explain what is going on, to call for peace, they used that note as if it were the letter of resignation, and I say they are lying.
When you went into the car from your house, did you understand you were going to the airport and being flown out?
Not at all, because this is not what they told me. And we did our best to avoid bloodshed. We talked with them somehow in a nice diplomatic way to avoid bloodshed. We played the best we could in a respectful way, in a legal and diplomatic way, because they told me that we were going to have bloodshed. Thousands of people were going to be killed, including myself. As I said, it wasn't for me, because I never cared about me, my life, my security without, first of all, seeing the security and the life of all the people. I was elected to protect the life of every single citizen. So that night, I did my best to avoid bloodshed. And when they took me, putting me in their plane, that was their plan, while my strategy was doing all I could to avoid bloodshed.
Are you being held in the Central African Republic against your will?
Actually, against my will, exactly. Let me tell you, we spent 20 hours in the American plane with American soldiers, including 19 American agents who had an agreement with the Haitian government to provide security to us. They were also in that plane, maybe, to keep the truth in the plane instead of having one of them telling the truth out of the plane, because one of them had a baby 1 year and a half in the plane, and he's an American guy. They didn't give him a chance to go out of the plane with the baby. My wife, the first lady, who was born in the United States from father and mother, Haitians native, she didn't have the right to even move the shade and look at through the window, which means they violated their own law. Until 20 minutes before I arrived here, I knew where they were going to land, which means clear violation of international law. Unfortunately, they did that, but fortunately, I pay tribute to the government of Central Africa for the way they welcomed us. It was gracious, human, good, and until now, this is the kind of relationship which we are developing together. And I thank them for that once again.
What do you want to happen now?
I always call for peace. Those who realize their kidnapping cannot bring peace with their violence in my country. CARICOM, which means all the heads of all the Caribbean countries, call for peace and restoration of constitutional order. The same way we heard the voice of American senators, American members, U.S. members, members of the U.S. Parliament, they're all with U.S. citizens, and the Haitian diaspora are calling for peace, for the restoration of the constitutional order. This is what I also call for. And allow me to give you a very simple example. This means for us investing in education, investing in healthcare. In my country, after 200 years of independence, We are the first black independent country in the world, but we still have only 1.5 Haitian doctors for each 11,000 Haitians. We created a university, we founded a university, whose the Faculty of Medicine has 247 students. Once U.S. soldiers arrive in Haiti after the kidnapping, what do? They close the Faculty of Medicine, and they are now in the classroom. Can you imagine that? This is what they call peace, which is the opposite of peace. Peace is investing in human beings, investing in healthcare, respect for human rights, not violation for human rights, not violation of the rights of those who voted for an elected president. And this is what we wish. We wish that women in the world, today this is their day, I pay tribute to them. Men in the world, all together, we can continue to work hard to restore peace and constitutional order to Haiti.
President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, speaking to us from the Central African Republic, where he was taken after his ouster from Haiti. We come back, we'll continue with this rare interview, and then we'll be speaking with Laura Flanders. Her new book is called Bushwomen, and Native American leader Winona LaDuke. Stay with us.
We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, we are the ones here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, this news conference that he held this morning before the interview that we did was precipitated by a U.S. delegation arriving in the Central African Republic yesterday. They went to the gates of the Palace of the Renaissance, where he and Mildred Aristide, the First Lady of Haiti, were taken after they were ousted from Haiti after an extended plane ride. Yesterday, they went to the gates, the U.S. delegation. They were told they could not meet with the president. Afterwards, the delegation went to a hotel, but the foreign minister of the Central African Republic held a news conference, called a news conference. The press came, including more than a dozen international press, and when they set up to record the news conference where Mildred Aristide was brought out, armed men came into the room and threatened the reporters, saying they could not record that news conference. But the foreign minister did say that President Aristide would make a statement within the next 72 hours. And so today, just a little while ago, he did hold that news conference. And right after the news conference, we were able to speak to him on the cell phone. It is not easy to understand, but we felt it was critical to bring you the most extended interview he has done in English to date. This is President Jean-Bertrand Aristide speaking from the Central African Republic. Do you want to return as president to Haiti now?
If it's possible now, yes, now. Whenever it's possible, I am ready, because this is what my people voted for.
Are you being held, do you see yourself as being held as a prisoner in the Central African Republic?
Here, I say it again, the people and the government and the president, President Bozizé, they are gracious the way they treat us. I just pay a public tribute to them. And if you have a citizen of the Republic of Central Africa listening to me, allow me to tell them singular minimum, which means thank you very much, because their country is a country called Zo Kwezo in their language, which means every human being is a human being. All that to say, they are grateful to them. But when you are living in a house or in a palace, they put us in their palace, which is a great sign of respect for us. When we are living in those conditions, although we feel good because of the way they welcome us, we also feel we should be in Haiti with the Haitian people, doing our best to keep investing in education, in health care, building a state of law, slowly but surely building that state of law.
President Aristide, at least 5 people were killed in Haiti on Sunday. Opposition leaders say it was pro-Aristide forces that opened fire, also including a journalist, a Spanish journalist based in New York, was shot dead. Another was also shot. Your response?
First of all, I wasn't there, and I don't have many pieces of information to comment, but with the respect I have for the chief, I will make some comments. But I say it again, I wasn't there. I don't have yet any information, so I cannot go too far in my way to analyze the situation. I do believe, because for the past years, each time drug dealers like Guy Philippe, people already convicted like Chamblain, kill people, we heard exactly what I just heard. They blame the nonviolent people. They blame the poor. When you are poor, you are violent in their eyes. That's the way they do it. But when you are already convicted, oh, you are not violating human rights. So I think, or I suspect, they are lying when they talk like that, accusing my followers.
What message do you think the United States is sending the people of Haiti and the rest of the world in their actions with you?
I think the citizens of the United States supporting democracy in Haiti, as the Haitian people, as the diaspora, you saw Haitians in Washington, in Brooklyn, in Miami, in Boston, elsewhere, calling for my return to Haiti and the constitutional order. I think all the citizens of the United States linked to the diaspora moving this way are sending a very strong positive signal to all the countries in the world willing to fight in a peaceful way for democracy. But those who kidnapped me are sending a very wrong signal, because if you don't respect the result of a democratic elections, and then you kidnap the elected, and then you do that here and elsewhere, the signal you are sending is no to democracy while you are talking about democracy. So that's why I wish they will correct what they did, they will realize they were wrong, and they will have a new approach which will be sending them the right signal to the rest of the world. Because in the world, what do we need? We need peace. What do we need? We need democracy. What do we need? We need to invest in human beings. Therefore, to do that, we should not send wrong signals as they do. They went to Iraq. We see how is the situation in Iraq. They went to Haiti. We see how is the situation in Haiti. Pretending, imposing democracy, we saw people killing people. Why don't they change their approach to let democracy and the constitutional order flourish slowly but surely? After imposing an economic embargo on us, being from a cultural point of view very rich, from an historic point of view, very rich, but from an economic point of view, very poor, because we are the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere, after imposing their economic embargo upon us, because the people wanted one vote, so equality among us. Then they use drug dealers, they use people who are already convicted, pretending to lead a rebellion, while they went to Haiti killing people in Gonaïves, killing people in Capetian, killing people in Port-au-Prince and elsewhere. And now they continue in the face of the entire world, blessing impunity, supporting those killers. My God, I think it's really ugly, that image they project in the face of the world. Now it's time for them to change. We respect them, but we also respect the truth. That's why respectfully we are telling them the truth. I said, when someone is wrong, the wrong way to behave is to continue to be wrong. The right way to behave is to move from wrong to being right. Now it's time to move from being wrong on their side to become right by supporting the constitutional order.
President Aristide, Vice President Dick Cheney said, you wore out your welcome in Haiti. It's time for you to go. He also said, can I get your response to that?
How can someone, after the kind of elections they had, now talk like that regarding Haiti, where we had fair democratic elections, regarding the elected president? I think someone can have power, but that doesn't mean we cannot see the truth and say the truth. I respect the rights of every single citizen in the world to talk, and we have to be tolerant, because this is also about democracy. That's why I have respect for him. I respect his way to talk, but at the same time, I have respect for my people and for the truth. I say, and I say it again, the Haitian people are a nonviolent people. They voted for democracy. They will continue to fight in a peaceful way for democracy, and I will continue to be faithful to them, doing the same. A peaceful approach, fighting peacefully for the restoration of the constitutional order.
Do you still consider yourself president of Haiti?
Yes, because the people voted me. They are still fighting in a peaceful way for the elected president. I cannot betray them. That's why I will do my best to respect their will.
Well, how would you describe the situation in Haiti today? U.S. and French forces and Canadian troops are in Haiti. It is something you called for before you left to support you and to protect you there then.
Yes, I called for before they forced me to leave the country. Now, unfortunately, when they are in Haiti, they don't have the elected president with them to move with the constitutional order. But despite of that, I wish the United Nations in Haiti, through peacekeepers, can help keeping peace in the country, protecting all the Haitians, every single Haitian, because the life of every single man or woman is sacred. We have to respect that. So I wish they will protect the life and the rights of every single citizen by the time we continue to work hard, peacefully, to restore democracy to Haiti. In Haiti.
Vice President Cheney said, I've dealt with Aristide before when I was Secretary of Defense. We had a crisis involving Haiti. He left of his own free will. He signed a resignation letter on his way out. He left with his security detail on an aircraft we provided, not a military aircraft, but civilian charter. Now I suppose he's trying to revise history. But the fact of the matter was he'd worn out his welcome with the Haitian people. He was democratically elected, but he never governed as a Democrat. He was corrupt, and he was in charge of many of the thugs that were committing crimes in Port-au-Prince. The suggestion that somehow the United States arrested him or forcibly put him on an aircraft to get him to leave, that's simply not true. I'm happy he's gone. I think the Haitian people are better off for it. I think now they'll have an opportunity to elect a new government, and that's as it should be.
Well, as I said before, he has the right to talk, and I respect his right. As I have the right to say the truth, and I will be saying the truth. I disagree with him, and I will continue to believe that the Haitian people will continue to fight in a peaceful way to restore democracy. And when the day will come to have elections, of course, the huge majority will talk. Unfortunately, those who always supported coup d'etat never wanted the Haitian people to keep moving from elections to elections. They prefer the Haitian people to move from coup d'etat to coup d'etat. We celebrated 200 years of independence. We had, unfortunately, 32 coup d'etat. And we know, usually, who can choose to be behind coup d'etat. So now that we just had the kidnapping, which they call resignation, which others call coup d'etat, it's clear some people will do their best to justify what they may not be able to justify, as I will continue to be on the side of the truth, on the side of the human rights, on the side of all those who know about what happened and stand firm with the Haitian people. The heads of the Caribbean countries stand firm for the restoration of the constitutional order for peace. We have senators in the states, members of the U.S. House, citizens in the states, standing firm for peace, for democracy, for constitutional order. I am joining them.
Why do you think the United States government does not want you to be the president of Haiti?
Maybe if we could just one single example, it can tell the world a lot. I don't know if I already told you that, but I will go through it again. In 200 years of independence, making Haiti the first black independent country of the world, we still have 1.5 Haitian doctors for each 11,000 Haitians. When we founded the university, whose the Faculty of Medicine has 247 students, once the U.S. kidnapped me, they are now in that Faculty of Medicine. They close it, and the students are out, and this is what they decided to do. So if you have a government or a president willing to invest in health care, apparently they don't want that. If you have a president or a government willing to invest in education, maybe they don't want that. I will continue to believe we must invest in human beings, we must invest in education and health care. This is what will bring peace. Because peace, it's not an empty word. It has to be full. Investing in education, in healthcare, bring the real peace to a country. And what they call peace is not the real peace. This is violence. This is kidnapping. What we call peace through education is telling the world that we are right.
President Aristide, in your news conference, did you say that your country is now in the midst of an unacceptable occupation?
It's an occupation. And the last example I just gave says about occupation. How can you imagine you come to me, you want to bring peace, and you close my university, you send out 247 students of medicine in a country where we don't have hospital, we don't have enough doctors? God, this is an occupation. When you protect killers, when you protect drug dealers like Guy Philippe, like Chamblain, when you protect a citizen of the United States violating the law of the United States, Mr. André Appel is a citizen of the United States violating the neutral act, the way he is acting, destroying our democracy. And once you do that, then this is an occupation.
Is it true that, did you say that your security force around that protected you in Haiti from the Steele Foundation, that they were told by the U.S. government they could not send in reinforcements?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they obliged them to stop providing security, and 25 more were supposed to come the day after. They were presented to come. So it was a clear strategy to move their way according to their plan. Well, now time is gone. Unfortunately, I need to stop because they just asked me to leave.
Do you think you will ever see Haiti again as president?
I will. I will once the Haitian people and the international community continue to work hard. It's not impossible.
What do you think people can do in the United States?
I think they can continue to mobilize human resources to support peace for Haiti, democracy for Haiti. This is what the Haitian people want, peace and democracy.
Will you be leaving the Central African Republic? Do you want to leave?
No. They are not asking me to leave the country. They are asking me to end the...
I understand. I understand, but do you want to leave the country? Do you want to return immediately to Haiti?
If I can go today, I would go today. If it's tomorrow, tomorrow. Whenever time comes, I will say yes to my people, those who elected me.
What is stopping you from returning today?
Because we need to clear the way, and that's what we are doing now.
Thank you very much for joining us, President Aristide.
Thank you so much for you, and wishing we can meet again in Haiti.
Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, speaking to us today from the Central African Republic. If you would like to read a transcript of this conversation, we will have it up on our website at democracynow.org. Again, the Haitian president accusing the U.S. of kidnapping him and of forcing him out of the country, saying that they are behind a coup d'etat in Haiti, calling what is happening there now an occupation. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Laura Flanders and Winona LaDuke. Stay with us.
Walking down this railroad track, I got tears in my eyes, trying to read a letter from my home. If this train run me right, I'll be home by tomorrow night, 'cause I'm 900 miles from my home. And I hate to hear that lonesome whistle blow. Well, this train I ride on, 100 coaches long, Hear the whistle blow 100 miles. If this train run me right, I'll be home by tomorrow night, 'cause I'm 900 miles from home. And I hate
900 miles, Odetta, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. It is International Women's Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao went to Iraq as U.S. casualties crossed the 500 mark this January. She turned up in Baghdad with a message for Iraqi women. In a democracy, the most important factor is energy, she said. For their part, the Iraqi women requested the United States institute quotas for women in the U.S.-appointed governing council. Women make up a majority of the population, received only 3 seats of the 25-member council. No women participated in the Constitution Writing Committee. At that time, Chao rejected any form of quotas. Women should rise by their own effort, she said. At the same time, Madre was reporting Yanar Mohammed, founder of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, was receiving death threats for her efforts to stand up for women's equality. Chao appears to have uttered not one word about Yanar Mohammed's plight. She did, however, leave the women of Iraq with a present, a framed photograph of her and other senior women officials at the U.S. Labor Department. That is the ending of a piece that Laura Flanders has written in the latest Nation magazine, and it is adapted from her new book, Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, that is being published today. She joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! And congratulations, Laura.
Great to be here, Amy, and congratulations to you on that fantastic interview with Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Well, Bushwomen. Let's talk briefly today in this truncated interview because of the interview with Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We're sorry to abbreviate our conversations now, but you'll be back tomorrow, Laura,
back
for a more extensive discussion about who the Bushwomen are. Lay out, though, the overview, the thesis for your book.
Well, typically, Amy, on International Women's Day, we do the job of revealing the uncovered achievements of women. Normally, they're the achievements that we are proud of or that women have a right to feel excited about. In this case, Bushwomen is really an extension of that project. I am revealing the underreported accomplishments of the women in the Bush administration, the cabinet secretaries, Ann Veneman, Elaine Chao, the inner circle folks, Condoleezza Rice, Karen Hughes. My suggestion or my allegation here is they're being used as kind of identity politics puppets to provide a kind of estrogen shield on this administration as it actually pursues policies that leave people more divided than ever before, rolling back civil rights and women's rights protections and worker rights protections in the workplace. The corollary to their spin job from the White House is that this is a very stereotype-sodden media world that we live in, as you and I know so well. So talk women, reporters report their personal stories. Talk about women, you hear about their family, what they're wearing. When Condoleezza Rice was appointed National Security Advisor, the New York Times ran a long story that focused almost entirely on her makeup, her hair, her dress. Didn't talk about her record at Chevron. Didn't talk about her record in the first Bush administration until I think it was the 31st paragraph or some such thing. I suggest at the beginning of this book that we might not even have the Bush administration in the White House if one woman had been taken more seriously and laughed at less, Catherine Harris, Treasury Secretary of State of Florida, who, as you recall, was mostly reported on the basis of how much makeup she wore.
I mean, that is a very key point when you look at the Bush administration overall, how it came into being and how you start this book with Catherine Harris.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story. At the time, I was kicking everyone. I mean, you talk to a Florida reporter, they knew her history, came from a very ambitious family, highly connected to one of the wealthiest citrus-growing groups in the state, somebody who had campaign contribution violations in her very first run for office. When she was appointed Secretary of State, the top election cop, Common Cause of Florida said, how do you expect somebody to uphold the law that she herself has a history of violating? Floridians knew who she was, but as you know, the D.C. press corps and the press corps following the election fly in. They weren't curious. They didn't know. And for weeks, they stonewalled the story of what had actually happened in the run-up to that election, what happened during that election process, the cleansing of the voting rolls and so on and so forth. Catherine Harris was at the center of a corrupt election campaign. But instead, what we got were jokes about, as the Washington Post dedicated an entire article to the subject, how she applied or seemed to apply her makeup with a trowel.
President Bush was hailed as having a cabinet that looks like America, more so than any other president.
It was a spin job, and it worked very well. He was hailed as having remade the Republican Party when he appointed Ann Veneman, Agriculture Secretary, Christy Todd Whitman, EPA, Elaine Chao, Labor, Gail Norton, Interior Secretary, and having the first ever African-American woman National Security Advisor and the most powerful woman in the White House, Karen Hughes. He was hailed as having remade the party. He'd really just remade its image, and I suggest that these women were a key part of that. They do for the Republican Party's image what all that language about pro-life does for its rhetoric. They make it look kind of family-friendly. The reality is very different, and that's what this book gets at. These are serious people who should be taken seriously, and we'll have equality for women when women and people of color are grilled as aggressively and given as much scrutiny as their male companions.
Tomorrow we're going to go through each of the women's records, not their wardrobe, we promise. But tonight, you're having a very interesting event in New York, which you will also have something similar to in San Francisco.
Indeed.
On March 18th. But can you just describe what the performance will be?
Well, there's going to be a variety of different performers taking part, and Jill Nelson, the journalist, will be performing as Condoleezza Rice. We've got a very interesting speech by Condoleezza's father, Dean Rice, John Rice, speaking out against the Vietnam War in 1971. Charles Turner, who played King Lear in New York recently, will be performing as John Rice. Then we have, courtesy of Lynn Chapman and Lola Paschalinsky at the New York Theatre Workshop, adapted Lynn Cheney's 1981 gothic novel Sisters for the stage. This is a breathy gothic romance featuring lesbian love and condoms and free sex in front of the fireplace between people who are not married. It's a fun job. It's a fun piece of work. Horribly written, let me just say. Funnily enough, it's dropped off Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife's resume. Her official biography at the White House doesn't include this, but it was one of the published works that got her the job as the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. She got that job because she was a published author. We're going to take a look at what she actually wrote and have a few laughs, we hope.
Well, Laura Flanders, I definitely look forward to that tonight, and we can talk about it tomorrow in part two of this interview. And tonight's event's taking place for those of you who are in New York.
At 7 p.m. at the New York Theater Workshop, which is on East 4th Street between Bowery and 2nd Avenue.
Laura Flanders, author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species. It is being released today around the country. And again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, it is International Women's Day, and to mark the occasion this weekend, the anti-war group Code Pink issued President Bush a 40-foot-tall pink slip during a demonstration on Sunday that was held aloft by hot air balloons. On Saturday night, Code Pink celebrated International Women's Day with a concert and spoken word performance. Among those who were there was Winona LaDuke, the longtime indigenous rights activist and 2000 Green Party running mate of Ralph Nader. She joins us in the studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank
Winona.
You. Hello.
You were also in Washington on Thursday for a very important event at the Smithsonian Institution, remembering some very important women.
The event was actually here.
Oh, it was here?
Yeah, at the Museum of the American Indian here, and it was a memorial, a fifth-year memorial for our relatives, Ingrid Washington-Watuck and Lahi Ney, who were assassinated by the FARC in Colombia 5 years ago, March 4th, 1999. And so this was their fifth-year memorial, and, you know, a lot of people from the community came in, and musicians, and we honored their lives and talked about, you know, what happens when you give military aid to countries like Colombia and why we oppose the war as women.
Also involves oil.
It does involve oil. I mean, a lot of the undercurrents for, you know, the United States is consumes more than anybody else in the world. You know, we consume a third of the world's resources, and we have to, as a consequence, have a relationship with much of the world, which has to do with collecting those resources. And so it involves a constant intervention into other people's countries and a constant violation of other people's human rights.
You're headed to a powwow in Denver that is connected in an unusual way to this.
On my way. I'm going to have to do a little work before I get to go to the powwow. My family is all dancers. And it's called Denver March Powwow, one of the largest Western powwows. And anyone should come. You guys should enjoy yourselves at some of these events. But we're launching a campaign called Wind Not War, which is about the alternatives to a fossil fuels-based economy and looking at wind and alternative energy as key to that in terms of issues of global climate change as well as issues of democracy.
The motto of the campaign?
Wind, not war. And it comes from, you know, Native communities have provided a good portion of the country's energy resources. About 20% of the energy resources come from Indian communities. We are the people in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We're the James Bay Dams. We're the big combustors in the Southwest, Navajo, that keep the lights on in Las Vegas and Los Angeles. And we are the CO2 emitters of the West. And our communities also have a good portion of oil. And if you're going to spend most of your time in your democracy figuring out how to get oil by intervening into other people's countries and ensuring that you follow it with military might, we think that there's an alternative, which would be renewable energy. And, you know, the reality is that this democracy has been compromised by oil interests as well as other things. But give me a good argument that oil companies aren't some of the most powerful interests in the country. I'd like to see that argument, whether it's ExxonMobil or Halliburton, you know, those kinds of interests. And turns out that our Indian communities are, go figure, we're like the windiest places in the country. I'm not sure how that worked out, but that would be us. So there's 23 Indian reservations in the western United States that have about 300 gigawatts of wind potential. That represents about half of present U.S. electrical consumption. We think it's an issue of energy justice. Instead of putting dams on us and nuclear waste dumps, we think we should have some wind towers and put the first one up last year. And we're looking at putting up a whole bunch more wind towers, and that is the campaign we're talking about. It is an alternative.
Winona LaDuke, we got a press release from NAJA, from the Native American Journalists Association, saying where is the coverage? For more than a week now, the press release said, Native people across the United States and Canada have expressed their outrage over the stereotyped outcast performance at the 46th Grammy Awards. The Native media did an admirable job of covering the controversy, but in contrast to the wall-to-wall coverage generated by Janet Jackson's halftime show, the outcast performance has raised barely a whisper among the mainstream media. Native people again find themselves out of sight, out of mind. We only have a minute, but can you describe what happened and what it is that so many are objecting to?
The idea that you can dress up in some kind of fake Indian outfit and get on stage is somehow become acceptable in this country. And that has to do with the fact that you've got the Redskins, the Braves. You have, you know, people who dress up like Indians. People dress up like Indians on Halloween. You know, I mean, that is what has become acceptable. And so recognizing instead that people have the right to human rights, to dignity, to control over their imagery and their identity. You know, America totally, instead of dealing with Native people, commodifies us and objectifies us. And so, you know, Outkast goes on and horrifies most of Native America. And because America is so accustomed to some kind of depiction of Native people that is entirely racist, there's a perception that that is okay.
Winona LaDuke, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Winona LaDuke is the 2000 Green Party vice presidential candidate. Your thoughts in 10 seconds on Ralph Nader running again?
I think he should run. If it's a democracy, anybody who wants to run should be able to run for office. If you don't like him, don't vote for him. And if you want to vote for him, do.
Winona LaDuke, Ojibwe activist from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website, democracynow.org. Tell your friends, read the President Aristide interview. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.